Hello, and welcome to another episode of Confectionery Conversations, the Candy Industry Magazine podcast. I'm Candy Industry Senior Editor Liz Parker. Today we're talking to Anthony Fountain from Voice Network. He's the Managing Director there. Voice Network is a global network of NGOs and trade unions working on sustainability in cocoa, tackling issues such as poverty, deforestation, and child labor. Thanks so much for joining us today, Anthony.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me, Liz.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, for example, what you do for Voice Network and your background?
Yeah, so I am, like many people in the cocoa sector, completely not educated in the field that I'm working in. I'm originally an historian and a rock musician, actually. I spent the first 10 years of my working life trying to become a professional musician. I was close, but not quite. But for the last 17 years, I've been working in the cocoa sector and at Voice. We're a small staff, so I do most of the stuff that's got to do with content. I have a few people that help on process and back office and things like that. But so we do a lot of research and a lot of advocacy and spokespersonship for sustainability in the cocoa sector.
Okay. Thanks. And today we're talking about specifically the Cocoa Barometer Report. So I wanted to ask you, how long has the report been around? Like, when did it get started and who came up with the idea for it?
So when I got involved in the cocoa sector back in 2006, one of the first things we did is we started working together with a few other organizations in Europe that had started to converge around tea, coffee, and cocoa. And that group called the Tropical Commodity Coalition decided to do a few state of the sustainability reports on tea, coffee, and cocoa, including in 2009 and 2010, a cocoa barometer at the time. So I was kind of slightly involved as one of the members of this coalition. But when in 2011, this coalition stopped, we had already started with the Voice Network. And so we kind of took over doing those publications. So the first one I did was in 2012.
Okay. And then the report from this past year, the 2022 report, it found that sustainability issues within global cocoa supply chains will continue unless efforts are coupled with the payment of a higher farm gate price for cocoa. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So there's a lot of challenges that are facing the cocoa sector. I often use an analogy of, you know, the problem tree of cocoa has two very large branches. And one is the environmental branch, where we're looking at deforestation and kind of incorrect use of agrochemicals, et cetera, climate change. The other big branch is the human rights challenge, where child labor often comes to the forefront. But there's also quite a few other issues around labor and workers' rights, around gender equality, et cetera, et cetera. But both of those branches, they stand firmly on the pillar, kind of on the trunk of the tree, which is farmer poverty. To tackle farmer poverty, we've tried a lot of things in the cocoa sector. We've got good agricultural practices and farmer field schools and crop diversification and productivity enhancement programs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it's almost like I once bumped into this cartoon where, you know, two people are talking and one of them is saying to the other, "We have to think of out-of-the-box solutions." And they're standing next to this box. And the other person asks him, "So what's inside the box?" And the first person says, "Well, we don't talk about what's inside the box." Where inside the box is, actually, we need to pay the farmers more. I mean, the thing is if we care about the poverty of farmers, it's not really rocket science to think that part of the solution might be to give them more money. Now, that's the kind of the more abstract principle part of it. But we've also been doing a lot of research and some real numbers crunching there. And with the cost of production that comes with increased productivity, we just don't see the maths, how they work for increasing productivity, how that would lead to extra net income for the farmer. It leads to extra gross income for the farmer. But it's going to cost a lot of time and effort and investment to get there. And so probably there's actually not that much value added for the average farmer to increase their productivity very much. They're just not going to get more money at the end of the month.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So can you talk about other problems that exist within the cocoa community families? You touched on a little bit right there.
Yeah, I mean, all of these problems are also very often intertwined because they're issues that deal with developmental challenges. They're issues that deal with, you know, centuries of colonial and post-colonial exploitation of the global South by the global North, etc. You know, this poverty is driving so many other issues there where, you know, if you have to choose between feeding your family and protecting the rainforest behind your farm, it's not a choice. You know, you're going to go and try to cut down more trees in order to grow more produce to feed your family, right? Mm-hmm. And so we see a huge challenge around deforestation. You know, the estimates vary, but, you know, at least 80, if not even 95% of the original old growth forest cover has disappeared from West Africa, which is where the vast majority of the world's cocoa comes from. The rainforests there are to a large extent cut down, with the exception of some natural parks and forests that are still there, and even they are being encroached upon. And there's some major challenges there. Further environmental challenges we're seeing because of this poverty. It's actually often a lot more interesting for farmers to sell their land or sell the rights of their land to allow artisanal small-scale mining to come in there, gold mining particularly, which is absolutely disastrous for the environment, for the farm. The trees will be cut down, the ground will be cut open, chemicals will be used. So those are major challenges. But if you cut down the rainforests are rain machines. If you cut down the rain machines, you drastically alter rainfall patterns. And that's what we've also seen in West Africa. Climate change is not a future problem in West Africa. The weather patterns in West Africa have significantly changed over the past decades already due to this massive deforestation. Now, it's not just cocoa driving this deforestation, but cocoa is a major part of that. And then on the other big branch of the tree, we see human rights issues where there's like upwards of 1.5 million children working in inappropriate labor on their farms. Now, there's often this idea that all the kids would be slaves, or on the other side that, you know, the kids are just helping out on the farm after school. Neither of those two are true. There's a lot of definitions around what you talk about when you talk about child labor. And most of these definitions, I think it's really important to point out, are defined at a national level. So in Cote d'Ivoire, the Ivorian government determines what is and what is not age appropriate labor, and so therefore what is and what is not hazardous child labor. Same thing goes for Ghana. In Accra, the government decides what the hazardous activity framework list is. And so, you know, there's kids, you know, I grew up on a farm and I never did child labor, but I did help out after school regularly, especially in harvest time and stuff like that. Now, if you do stuff that is age appropriate, if you do stuff that is not dangerous for you, that is not too many hours, that doesn't get in the way of your school, then it is not child labor. It is something that technically is called child/light work. And it is appropriate for a child to be involved in that when they grow up on a farm. In fact, it's one of the ways that children can learn the profession from their parents. So that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about child labor. There's upwards of 1.5 million children involved in child labor in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire growing cocoa. And that child labor means that it's actually not age appropriate, that it's too long work hours, that it gets in the way of their education. And in fact, the vast majority of this 1.56 million, upwards of 80, maybe even upwards of 90% of these kids are actually in what we call hazardous child labor, or the worst forms of child labor. And that means that they're actually doing things that are detrimental to their health, which means that they're carrying loads that are too heavy, that they're exposed to agrochemicals. Doesn't mean they have to be applying it, but they can just be exposed to it either on the farm or because it's stored at home and it's also dangerous to them. It means that they're using tools and machinery that they shouldn't be using. They don't have protective clothing. It means means that they're involved in burning the underbrush. It basically means that they're doing stuff that's dangerous for them. And in fact, most of the kids involved in this hazardous child labor are actually not involved in just one thing that is hazardous, but usually two or three, or sometimes even four or five different kinds of inappropriate, dangerous labor. Now, that's the big challenge that we're talking about when we're looking at the child labor side of things. But there's also this massive cross-cutting issue, whether it's environmental or human rights, etc., around gender inequality, where women simply do not have the same access to rights and access to support. They don't have the same decision-making capability. I mean, they could, as persons, easily, actually, they usually make better decisions, but they just don't get given the opportunity to do that, and often have to do quite a lot of the work themselves. So really, it's like cocoa is a microcosm of all the problems that you see in global commodity chains, just about.
Okay. Thank you for elaborating on that. The next question is kind of pivoting a little, but also similar. How do West African farmers struggle with the cost of living crisis?
It's been disastrous, especially in Ghana. I think it's important to understand the big difference between Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, the two biggest cocoa growing countries in the world. Cote d'Ivoire is part of the Franc CFA zone. So there's this block of countries in West Africa that have the same single currency, and that single currency is coupled to the euro. Now, that is bringing a cost of living crisis, but inflation is reasonably manageable because the euro doesn't inflate very badly. And so there's been a significant cost of living crisis, especially since the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, that has directly actually impacted agriculture, because it's had a huge impact on the cost of inorganic fertilizers. And that's, you know, an input that cocoa farmers use quite a lot. So that's been massively impactful, both in Cote d'Ivoire and in Ghana. But, you know, even before the Russian invasion, actually foodstuffs had gotten quite a lot more expensive as well because of the pandemic and the effects that that had on global shipping costs. And bizarrely enough, Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana are both big agricultural powerhouses, and at the same time import a lot of food because they are agricultural powerhouses for commodities for export. And so, you know, it's problematic enough as it is in Cote d'Ivoire, where things like fertilizer and cement and other things you need to run a farm have become very expensive. If you then look at Ghana, that does not have the benefit of a stable currency, things are just beyond words. I mean, the challenges and the issues they are having in Ghana at the moment are just massive. Like late last year, they had an inflation rate of more than 40%, kind of ticking up to 50%. Now, couple that with the fact that most cocoa farmers are already dirt poor, and what they grow in on their farm is largely for export. It's not for personal consumption. And so sure, they've got, you know, they've got a plot of land where they grow part of their own food, but definitely not all of it. So there's some real big, massive, I think it's very hard to overstate the devastating consequences the cost of living crisis is having in particularly Ghana, also in Cote d'Ivoire, but particularly in Ghana at the moment.
For this and also the struggles you've talked about, is there anything the cocoa industry can do to improve these?
So as I said it earlier, if you care about people being poor, the first step that you might want to consider is how can we give them more money? Mm-hmm. That has been anathema until very recently. Now, the Ivorian and Ghanaian government started a cartel about four years ago, to try to drive up the world market price for cocoa. I would argue that they did not do that in the most effective manner. I think that intervening in price without doing anything about the dynamics of supply and demand is always going to be a very uphill battle, in kind of just because of the laws of economics. But they've tried to push the prices up at the world market level. And they've shown political resolve to back this. And so that's a continuing conversation that's taking place. And in the last 4 months or so, we've started to see a change in the way companies are willing to start to consider looking at their purchasing practices. And I think that's the key of the issue. Like, I've been in cocoa for, well, hitting two decades pretty soon now. And in those two decades, we've seen countless programs aimed at the farmer. The farmer needs to diversify his income. The farmer needs to increase his productivity. The farmer needs to stop having children work on his farm. The farmer needs to stop cutting down trees. The farmer needs, everything has been around what the farmers need to do differently. And very little has been about what the big companies need to do differently. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that the good agricultural practices and the farming practices that are there only make sense if there's actually a business case for this good farming to happen. And so we need to switch the conversation, or at least we need to switch the gravity of the conversation away from what the farmer needs to do differently. Because the farmer is not really the problem. The farmer is a symptom of a system. We need to switch our focus on, this is what the farmer is all doing wrong. We need to start looking at, how can we change the enabling environment? And when you're looking at changing the enabling environment, you're looking at two major things. You're looking at governance, and so access to market, infrastructure, education, you know, transparency of tax investments, and all of those things that governments have a really important role to play in. But you also have what we're starting to call good purchasing practices. And this is something that I think companies have failed so far to really do anything significant about. And that needs to change. And when we're talking about good purchasing practices, we're not just talking about higher farm gate prices, although that has to be a part of the conversation. We really need to see drastically higher prices paid at the farm gate. And but so we need more reward there for the farmer, but we also need to find ways to reduce their risk, because at the moment, the farmers, though they have the weakest shoulders of the whole supply chain, generally speaking, carry the heaviest burdens of risk on those same shoulders. If there's a potential crop failure, it's the farmer's problem. If there's a potential great year leading to an oversupply and therefore price collapse, it's the farmer's problem. If there is a tree disease or a pest that comes along, it's the farmer's problem, et cetera, et cetera. Companies can hedge their purchasings and their sales quite well through a wide range of instruments. Farmers can't do anything. And so we need to see higher prices, but we also need to see a way to take the risk away from the farmers. And I would argue that one of the best ways to do that is to start providing farmers with long-term contracts that are kind of asymmetrical in what they ask and what they deliver to farmers. And with that, I mean that they actually give the farmers more rights, and that they give the buyers, ergo the multinationals, more duties. And so that a farmer knows, look, if I deliver at this level of quality, then I know that I can sell to this company 2,000 kilos for the next 5 years. So I think that the main thing companies can do differently is change their purchasing practices, where they bring more risk, more reward to the farmer, and they're willing to share the risk with the farmer in a way that they're not doing yet.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense to me as well. That's all the time we have for today, but I wanted to thank you for your time today, Anthony.
You're very welcome, Liz. Thank you for your time, and it was a pleasure.
Thanks, and to those listening, thanks for listening. Be sure to tune in next time for another episode of Confectionery Conversations.